978-608-6407 to learn more. That number is 979-308-6407 to join the Houston chapter of ADAPT and advocate for the civil rights of people with disabilities. All ADAPT actions are nonviolent.
That is the mesmerizing beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. That means it's 8 p.m. on a Thursday evening and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories of all kinds. Right here on KPFT 90.1. I'm your host this evening, Eric Heen. And along with our regular hosts, Drs. Hank Rubicek, Mary Edgerton, Warren Holloman, and Greg Audell, and our engineer and media guru, Tatiana Gago, we bring you the power of story. We do this by bringing to you guests who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls. The memories of these journeys become a part of our lives. Please note that starting tonight, Thursday will be our permanent night, but I promise you everything else remains the same. We're still on at 8 o'clock, still live for an hour, and we're still bringing you great stories with great people. The only difference is that we've moved from Wednesdays to Thursdays. Well, when we hear stories about refugees, they're typically stories told by others, politicians, journalists, and so forth. But tonight, we have the good fortune to hear stories told straight from the refugees themselves. I have here four guests here in the studio from various countries, but they all share a common experience. They fled danger in their homelands to seek refuge here in America. And they're here to tell us their stories tonight. They are, in no particular order, Mustafa Faiz, originally from Afghanistan, Asinja Badil from Iraq, Salem Alimasi from the Republic of Congo, and Ahmed Mahmoud from Iraq. Now, before we get to their stories, some listeners might find some portions of these stories a bit disturbing because our guests here have been through some perilous situations, but we're not going to sugarcoat anything here tonight. We just want the raw truth of what they've been through. Our first guest tonight will be Mustafa Faiz. Mustafa moved to Houston with his family 16 years ago. He currently works as a REMAX realtor, where he always contributes a portion of his commission to charitable causes, including refugee causes. Mustafa currently serves on the board of the Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to creating opportunities for refugees, immigrants, and underserved communities. Welcome, Mustafa.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Eric.
Great. Mustafa, your story is unique in that you fled Afghanistan when you were 7, correct?
True.
And then you returned to your homeland to work for the U.S. Army as an adult.
Correct.
So how did it feel to return there after so many years?
It was weird, to say the least. I had left Afghanistan as a kid, and all these years I had an image of my homeland, right? Because I had moved from country to country. I always had this image of my homeland. I thought I knew I could connect with people. I could connect with my homeland.
Right.
But when I back went, it was not what I thought it had been. And it was just a weird feeling that maybe I just didn't belong here.
Right.
And for the Afghans for the folks, I was not an Afghan. I was a foreigner coming from America.
Kind of in no man's land.
Exactly.
There. Well, let's hear your story.
Okay. So, well, my story is a story of, you know, a 7-year-old realizing that something's deeply wrong with the world or my world, and now we have to leave everything behind. Of course, you know, the war in Afghanistan started. I mean, you can go on for hours talking about what caused it. But for a 7-year-old, it started when I saw my school on fire. And here I am just going with my dad. You know, I'm just riding he's riding his bike. We're just coming from the supermarket. Got some, you know, vegetables and some bread. And I see my school from the distance, and there's this thick, dark clouds of black smoke coming out. And that's when I realized that something was deeply wrong. And for the next couple of weeks, of course, I didn't go to school, and I knew why. And the war had actually come literally to our doorsteps. There were different factions that were fighting each other, and the shelling and the mortar rounds, the firing had come literally at our doorsteps. And it had gotten to a point where we couldn't stay in our home because of course, the threat. And I realized what my parents had to do. At nighttime, the whole street would actually take refuge in one of our neighbors' home, because that was the only home that they had started construction. It was never completed, but it was the only home in the entire street that had a basement. So we would all go at nighttime, take refuge, sleep there. And you were talking about hundreds of people in this dark basement. No food, no bed, nothing. We're just like, you know, resting against the walls, the concrete. I mean, you could just feel the rough concrete against your back, right? We would wait it out until morning time, until dawn. And then everybody would return back to their homes. And it was as if nothing had happened. Like, life was normal. People were going back to their jobs, their work. You know, you would see just normal life come out. Mm-hmm. And that lasted maybe 10, 12 days. We would just go night after night. That had become a routine. And it got to a point where we had to leave. And I'm so glad for my mom, who made the command decision, because this whole time, I mean, this has been going on for months and months and months. And, you know, we just hoped that it would settle down. We would just hope that one of the factions would prevail and they would win and the fighting would stop. But, you know, the hopefulness was there, but it never did, until my mom was like, no, we need to leave. Of course, my dad was saying, no, we can stay. It's okay. You know, we'll just wait it out. Maybe a few more days, maybe a week at max. But this one particular morning, we emerged out of that basement. We left, we came back, and we went inside our home. Mom got some clothes, some of her jewelry, just put it in her pockets, and there was no suitcases or anything. Whatever clothes we were wearing, that's what we left with our home. And I remember my dad just outside our main door, he decided to stay. He was like, I'm staying. I can't leave everything behind. Like, we have everything in our home. Like, I can't just leave it behind. But my mom was like, I don't give a crap here. I'm leaving. I'm taking the kids. It's not safe here anymore. We left. So imagine there's a caravan of people walking. There was no traffic, no cars. Imagine walking from downtown Houston all the way to Spring up north, walking. And here's a mother with kids, you know, me, I was 7, my sister was 6, and then a 1-year-old child in her lap. And, you know, I'm holding on to my mom, my sister, right? And so we're just walking, making this journey out of hazard. We made it to our aunt's place. It was relatively safe. There's no shelling, we still had electricity. But that evening, there was a knock on our door, and my dad came, and he was like, I'm so glad you guys left. And that was the last time I saw my home as a 7-year-old. That's my last memory of Afghanistan, when I left it. So I've been back and it's just not the same. And over here, especially with what's going on nowadays, you know, just the whole conversation around refugees and immigrants, it's okay, so we don't belong here, we don't belong back home, so where do we belong?
Okay, tell us about the when you went back to Afghanistan to work for the U.S. Army.
Yeah, so that was a right after college, I went in there as working different positions, cultural advisor and also an interpreter, combat, non-combat missions. We did that. I did that for about 4 years, and I was attached to the U.S. Army, and we were pretty much, you know, just working with the supporting the U.S. Army, the missions in Afghanistan. Again, it was very, very just different because even from working with the Afghan forces, yeah, I was coming from America. I was an American to them. And also for, you know, the Army units I was working with, I wasn't maybe not fully American, right? And I was, and to the Afghans, I wasn't fully Afghan. So that's what I was dealing with over there. But I would say, you know, look at the contribution. You know, because my story is also a story of contribution. And this story is, okay, what have we done after 16 years living in America? Well, I look at towards my sister, who is a doctor in California, right? And she's treating patients of all, you know, the community. I look towards my mom, who's been with, you know, with Houston ISD for the past 15 years now, just, you know, working as a special ed teacher, you know, taking care of the students in our communities. And I look towards all the other refugees and immigrants who've been here, who are contributing, and the stories that we hear on the radio, the news, oh my God, sometimes I don't know what to do except for laugh at them. It's like so not true.
That's why we have true refugees here this evening. We want to hear the true stories.
And thanks for making that happen. This is exactly the kind of conversations we need. So, you know, people get to hear from refugees themselves, their stories, what they've been through, how life has been, and what they're up to in our communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, our next guest is Asinja Badil. Asinja was born and raised in a small town in northern Iraq and is now a mother of two children. She's the operation manager at Gray Spear Capital and will soon graduate from the University of Houston with an MBA. Congratulations. Sinja is part founder of the Yazda organization, which supports the Yazidi, a minority ethno-religious group in Iraq. Sinja has recently traveled throughout the world with, and get this, with Nobel Peace Prize winner Nadia Murad and worked for her as a translator. Now, Asinja, you went from dodging bombs in the middle of a war to working with the Nobel Prize winner. There's got to be a story there. Okay, let's hear your story.
Thank you, Eric.
You bet.
Life has put me in many situations where I take tough decisions as a woman and as a mother. The first decision that I had to make in my life is where I left my village. Where I left my village in north of Iraq and joined my husband in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. I had many plans in my village to be an engineer, and I was almost finishing my high school. But then I had to move with him and live with him. After we got our two kids, the war knocked our door in 2003. And my husband lost his job. He had a business, a clothing store. And it was destroyed because of the war. So the only option for him was to work with United States companies that was there in Baghdad. But after 2 years of working with them, he got many threatening letters telling him that they will kill him because of his work and he has to leave. So he did not have any option, honestly. He had to leave and... we could not go with him, me and the kids, because we did not have passports at that time. We were planning to restart our life in Baghdad after the war, but that was not an option for us. So he had to live alone. He went to Istanbul, That was in 2000, the beginning of 2007. And he went there and he asked about those programs, the United Nations programs. They told him that you might be eligible for one because you worked with the United States and you might have a chance to go there with your family. Mm-hmm. But we cannot open a case for you unless your family is here. So he called me, told me you have to get passport and come to Istanbul as soon as possible. But it was just it was a tough decision because I have to leave Baghdad again and start my new life in Istanbul. The first thing I want to talk about is the other tough decision that I have to make when we took the taxi to go to the airport. The driver told me that there's a 50% that there was going to be a shooting on our way to the airport. So I had to make the decision by my own. So my husband told me, I don't know, it's up to you, but that's our only chance. I look at my kids. I have 2 years old and 4 years old. And honestly, it was the hardest decision that I took in my life. I cannot stay in Baghdad, and it's very hard to get to the airport to join my husband. But anyways, I felt that there's no life over there. I cannot do anything to support my kids. So I told him, okay, we will do it. We went there, and the taxi driver, he slowed down, and he told me, I think they are here. That's all what he said. And he was starting to sweat, and he was so nervous, and I was so afraid. So I turned to my kids. I held their hands. I told them we were going to play a game, hide and seek. When I tell you to hide, you immediately put your head down and go to the floor of the car. So, and the driver looked at me, he said, when I tell you now, you have to put yourself down too, because they will start shooting and we have to make our way back without getting hurt. And it was just like 5 seconds, I think, and he said, oh, they are here. I don't know where the shooting came from, honestly. I was just telling my kids now, just hide. And then they started crying, and I was so afraid. But we made it. He made it back home. We had to reschedule our trip again. This scenario repeated itself 3 times till we get to the airport. Now from the airport to Istanbul, starting another new life there, I didn't like it at all. It was the most difficult times. We don't have a right to work. We don't have a right to go to school. You're there just waiting. You don't know when they will call you or they will reject you. But it was, I think it was April. It was Wednesday when they called us and told us that we got our visa to the United States. Mm-hmm. That was the sign to begin a new life there. We traveled to United States, to Houston. It was 2008, June 2008. It was at night. We arrived at Houston at night. I didn't see anything. I wanted to see how Houston looks like from there, but it was night, and in the airport, Interfaith Ministries was there. Mm-hmm. They were sponsoring us. They took us to our apartment, and they started to talk about life in the United States and education. I asked many questions because I like what they do. Mm-hmm. With refugees, I told them, I think I will do what you guys do. Just tell me what degree that I need to get so I can be a caseworker at Interfaith Ministry. So they told me, just learn the language, learn the system, and you will be fine. Mm-hmm. I started my, I had my daughter. She was 3 at the time, so I couldn't go to school or work for about a year. I waited until she went to the pre-K. Then I start working part-time, and then volunteer also with all the agencies, all the refugee agencies in Houston. I also work in a private school as a teacher, as a math teacher.
Okay. Well, great story. Now, could you tell me a little bit more about the organization? You said you helped, you were co-founder of YASDA, correct?
YASDA.
Okay.
YASDA is a global organization that was formed in 2014 after what happened to Yazidi people, the Yazidi minorities in north of Iraq by ISIS. So we were a group of people, me, my brother, and a couple more, that we decided to do something for our people. So we started this organization. I was mainly doing fundraising and documenting stories of the women that they were captured as a sex slave for ISIS. One of them was Nadia Murad, the Nobel Prize winner. I met Nadia when she came here to Houston. We were working on her book, The Last Girl. Then I had to travel at that time to Germany with her and with the author, Jenna, to complete the book. So I stayed there, I guess, for about 2 weeks. Then we got an invitation for Amal Clooney. Mm. We went to London that time and we finished that.
And you worked with George Clooney?
A little bit.
Right. I wonder whatever happened to that cab driver you were talking about. I mean, earlier you told me he returned to your house.
Yes.
He's the one that suggested to drive through the bombs and the gunfire.
Yeah.
Do you ever know what happened to him?
I think he's still in Baghdad.
Really?
Yeah.
That guy's, I got to hand it to him. He really stuck his neck out for you.
Thank you.
Tatiana, are you there?
Right here.
Did I pronounce your name correctly this time?
Slightly better. You're getting there.
I'm getting there. Okay. Well, let's take a break here. I hear that when it comes to storytelling, that we're not the only game in town. Tell us about Houston's other storytelling venues, like Only You Can Do.
Well, sounds like a plan, Eric. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn how to construct a story and how to learn by listening to a story, thanks to the supportive members who make up the guild. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. The Guild not only sponsors our program, but hosts some great events, so be sure to visit their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all the great stuff coming up. And while you're checking things out on the Guild's page, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under Radio Program. There are over 400 stories, so you better get started. And if you don't own a radio, that's not an excuse, because you can listen to us stream live on KPFT.org and Facebook Live. Visit us on our So What's Your Story Facebook page and share it with your friends. And of course, we would love it if you like us when you leave. So What's Your Story is also on YouTube. Incidentally, tell us your program ideas or comments by connecting with anyone on our team at story@kpft.org. I will also get that address on our Facebook page. And remember our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy moving stories about a variety of themes and get acquainted with Houston's vibrant storytelling community. Next up is February 12th with Love Hurts. Make it an early celebration and make it a date night. Why not?
Yeah, I recommend The Moth highly. It's for less than the price of a movie ticket. You get 3 hours of entertainment, live entertainment. It's great. Go to The Moth. Okay, thank you, Tatiana, for staying on top of Houston's dynamic and growing storytelling community. This is Eric Heen, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And I am here this evening with my guests, Mustafa Faiz, Asinja Badil, Salem Alimasi, and Ahmed Mahmoud, telling us their stories of their experiences as refugees. Our next guest, Salem Alimasi, is a husband and father of two young children, and he's a refugee from the Republic of Congo. and he now works for a refugee organization himself. He's the resettlement caseworker for Interfaith Ministries of Greater Houston, and he's also the founder of CO Afro Community Center in Houston. Welcome, Salim.
Thank you.
Now, Salim, you have a fascinating story because you practically spent your entire childhood as a refugee.
Oh, yeah.
You're running from wars and living in refugee camps. Mm-hmm. When you were going through all that turmoil throughout your childhood, did you ever dream that you'd be in America?
Being honest, that was not a dream. Just I had a hope that one day I would survive, but I didn't know where or how.
Just wanted to survive.
That's what the goal.
Okay, well, we're glad you're here, Salim. Let's hear your story.
Well, my story started when I was 6 years old in Congo, somewhere called Uvira, is when the war started in Congo. That's 1996. It was just a Friday, a normal Friday as every other days. But we just hear heavy gunfire and people say they are coming. Who? We didn't know, but we know that the country was under war and we had to run from our country. I don't remember going back in the house to take anything. The way I was, just stand up and, hey, let's go. And we started going. It was a family, almost 30 to 37 people. We had one bicycle and we had to put whatever we could put to the bicycle. Just find any food and medication to see how we can make it through. And we were really going, reaching somewhere called Makobola. It was really heavy for us. And I imagine I was 6 years old, and at the moment, I lost track of my parents. What happened for me to lose them is I just opened my eyes, like lifting my head a little bit higher. I saw somebody killing people, like they're putting people in a house and they burn the house, people alive. Where my family was, I didn't know. From there, I just took off, started running, screaming, crying. I didn't know who will save and who will help me. And from there, I didn't see my parents anymore. Anybody from my family, I didn't know where they were, what they're doing, they're alive. I had no idea. And I call it a grace, just when I was going crying, I saw the pickup of my grandparents passing by, and they saw me, they stopped, they put me in, and that was our way going to Baraka, the Fizi side, which is the other side of Congo. And reaching somewhere called Kazimia, the grandparents decided that we should cross the lake Tanganyika to go to Tanzania as refugees. That's when we left. Like the run was not turning back. The run was like not turning back. Just go and save your skin and save your life. And when we got to Tanzania, we were first group of refugees from Congo to reach in that refugee camp called Nyarugusu. It was no easy at my age. I remember spending 1 week, wake up, just cry. I wake up, I start crying. All day I'm crying. I don't eat anything. When it's night, I sleep. When I wake up, I cry. For all week, I was doing that. And that's how I spent my 1 year and a half in a refugee camp. I became 7 years and a half. And Grandpa said we should go back home because they are saying everything is working good now. And we came back home. That was a miracle. When I saw again my house, I screamed like a baby, like screamed loud and crying and happy. The emotion was mixed. But we came home. Everything looks as nice, let me say that, because we could sleep in our house. But things was not prettier, as I can say, because my father was a pastor. He's still a pastor till now, and he was a human rights activist. So he used to announce or to speak against people who are doing illegal things or wrong things to others. When he was doing that, those guys who were doing bad things, they were not happy. They start killing some of his people they work with. So when they killed his president, Kabungulu Pascal, they killed his secretary, my father's secretary. I knew the guy. He was assassinated too. And it was really tough. My father was arrested more than one time. And he said, guys, I think we have no choice. We don't belong here anymore. The only option for us is to run away. Then when we left Congo again to go to Uganda, who became a refugee the second time, or I became a refugee for the second time in Nachivalo refugee camp. I remember sleeping in a church. When it's 4 a.m., they have to pray. We have to wake up. They pray. When it's 6, we just stay there. There's no work. Everything looks dead. Like there were no hope at all in the refugee camp. But we made it through. We made it through. And when after 3 years and a half, we just had a letter that you guys are going to America. That was like, no way. Is it happening? And we were glad to receive the letter. And now we're here. We thank God for that opportunity.
So you were in a refugee camps twice then?
Yes, sir.
See, I always pictured refugees camps as containing refugees for maybe weeks or a few months. But you spent years. You said 3.5 years in one?
Oh, yeah. I spent 3.5 years in Nachivalo, Uganda refugee camp. And I spent 1.5 years in Tanzania. There's people spend more than that. People spend 20 years in a refugee camp.
What was it like living in a refugee camp?
I don't want to dream that. I don't want to go back in that dream because, as I said before, you could not see life. There is no future at all. I remember in the refugee camp of Uganda, the water is green. It has a color. And that the water you are forced, if you don't drink, that's your problem. But that was the water. And they have to serve you like 7 pounds, let me use pound of coins for the whole family of 7 people for the whole month. That's how you depend on to survive. So that life is not something you can dream about.
Was the UN involved in that refugee camp, the UN?
The UN was there. The UN was there. They were the one even giving food out, like sugar. They tried to give something for people to eat or to have something to survive. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, it's quite a story, Salem. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
If I may add, Eric, to like refugee camps, you know, these are just pop out just because people have nowhere to go. And a lot of time, you know, people think these are like places you got like hot showers and, you know, there's a kitchen going on and the whole thing. And most of the time, you know, it's in the middle of a desert and people have nowhere to go and they just camp out for months and years, and you see children being born there. They're raised over there. They grow up there. And like Salem said, 20, 30 years, and sometimes people just die in a refugee camp. And that has been their reality of the world we live in.
Yeah. Here I used to tell people I had a tough childhood. I can't say that anymore. Wow. Okay, well, you know, I'm seeing a pattern here tonight that every one of you is still active in with refugee causes. So it's not like you only came to America here just for a better life for yourselves, like for more money or whatever, but you haven't forgotten other people that are in a predicament that you used to be in. So all four of you here apparently are still involved in refugee causes. I think that's great. Okay, our next guest is Ahmed Mahmoud from Iraq. Ahmed was born and raised in Iraq and immigrated to the U.S. in 2013. He holds a B.A. in Translation and Interpretation Studies, and he's also a certified financial coach. And Ahmed is currently a program manager at the Interfaith Ministries for Greater Houston. Welcome, Ahmed.
I thank you, Eric, for the chance. Thank you for KPFT and for the audience for their time to giving us the chance to talk about our stories and clarify some facts about refugees and immigrants.
Great. Well, thank you for being here. Now, it wasn't mentioned in your bio, but you also worked for a translator for the U.S. Army, correct?
Yes. I worked for the U.S. Army and started in 2004, and it was more than 6 years.
In Iraq. Okay, so we have two translators for the U.S. Army here, Mustafa in Afghanistan and you in Iraq.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's hear your story, Ahmed.
So my story, it might be like a little bit colorful back home, but it's not much different when it comes to the journey of my colleagues here. There is one like definite fact that I learned from my journey, that you don't have to be an immigrant or a refugee by choice. You don't want to be immigrant or a refugee. Most of us, I can say like all of us, we had to do this to survive, to protect our life or our kids. So for me, I had honestly a great life back home, a decent one. I had a decent education. I grew up in educated family, caring. And I was able to start and develop my own business and serve my communities there, which has like the business has great impact on people's life. I was an internet service provider, and I believe I introduced my city to a new level of access to the information as a part of the change that I believed and I took seriously. I started working for the U.S. Army in 2004 as a translator and interpreter. I really believed in change, and I remember one of the soldiers, he was like looking at me and like wondering like why you're doing this. And I just told him clearly, like, I really believed in change and I wanted to change, because like 23, 24 years old, young man, like full with dreams, like really passionate to change the situation there. I believe my supervisors, they saw something in me that met like my goals, willing to change and working hard to change, served their objectives as well. So they recommended me like from one to another. Like when they leave, they send me recommendation to the next unit, to the next POC, point of contact, that this is the guy who can help you to do your objectives, to meet your objectives. I honestly wasn't thinking about immigration or migrating to US until 2009. I never thought about it. I was working there. Everything was like fancy to me. I was doing what I was dreaming about. Until one night, I received a call from a team member and a dear friend. His name is Hamid. And he said, Omar is killed. And Omar is one of our team members, our team member. And Omar was like really close to me, as me and Hamid and Omar, we were all like studying English. So we spent like many nights like learning, listening to each other. And I learned, and I still remember like his words and teach. Unfortunately, Omar was kidnapped and killed. And his family found him in one of the city neighborhoods with a warning letter on his chest for all those who works or help the U.S. forces in Iraq, in that city at least. It was really hard to accept the fact that Omar is not there anymore in the team. A few days later, we had an attack on my own home. It was like a surprise. I wasn't expecting it. Light weapons and grenade shots on our house. Me and my brothers, honestly, my older brothers, they started like facing the attacks, trying to save our lives. Unfortunately, they used one of the neighbor's house to do these attacks, to have better like angle or whatever they're trying to do. After that, the whole neighborhood started looking at me differently, like not the young guy who feeds their knowledge always, who's trying to help them to do something or to understand something. They start looking at me as a dangerous person, like a dead man walking. They all should be away from. Beside the fact that they used the neighbor's house, and that's has a great impact on the neighbors and what they think about us being there. Until that time, I was like thinking about my choice, like the choice I made to start doing this kind of work. Was it right or wrong? And my family, they didn't like they were like really supportive from the beginning of this decision. Like when I was discussing this with them, they also wanted, because they believed that the change is coming. So they were supportive all the time. Unfortunately, even after leaving my home country and coming here in 2013, I left before ISIS invade my city 2 months. Mm. But they didn't forget about me. I am here in the United States, and one of my friends, he texted me a picture of my own house that they wrote on my wall, like belongs to the Khilafi, to ISIS. And he's telling me, like, they took all, like, all our belongings, thrown us in the streets, and they put someone in that house, like, just like it belongs to him. It's not ours anymore. On April, I'm very thankful for the U.S. government for this decision to accept Iraqis and Afghani interpreters, and they given us this chance as a special immigration visa. I came to Houston in 2014. That was in 2013, October. I was resettled by Interfaith Ministries as an SIV. And I took my first job in November after 1 month. That was my first job. Mm-hmm. As I really believed in myself that I shouldn't give up. My first job was a dishwasher in one of the Houston, Great Houston restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I love it, and I still love it. And I would do the same, no worries. As long as it helps me to be a productive member of this community. On April 2014, I started working for the same agency who resettled me, Interfaith Ministries, as a caseworker, as a case management caseworker. I believe I worked hard, and in 5 years, I was upgraded twice to become a project manager, mm-hmm. A program manager for Interfaith Ministries.
Right. It must have been quite a feeling to see a picture of the house you lived in, you grew up in, and you said they had graffiti on it or something. This house is owned by ISIS now?
Exactly. It belongs to ISIS. That's the translation for that word.
And they threw a grenade into your house, you said?
Yes, at the attacks. It was like, it's unforgettable. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was like really hard to trying to remember the events about that day.
Right. Now, I'd like to read an excerpt from a report the U.S. Army put together about you. You showed me this earlier. Would that be okay?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here it is. This is a report the U.S. Army wrote on Ahmed here while he was employed with them as a translator there. On more than one occasion, Ahmed's quick thinking has saved the lives of my men and me. He has prevented friendly fire from the Iraqi army and prevented enemy targets from attacking our soldiers. So, Ahmed, okay, I just wanted to clarify something here. You saved American lives over there.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, your own life was in danger because you worked for the U.S. Army, correct?
Yep.
And with all that, how long did it take you to get your visa?
It took me 4 years.
4 years.
To start the process and to get here.
Wow.
Yeah. And during these 4 years, I was living inside the U.S. bases. And I used to do at least one time vetting by the DODs inside the U.S. bases. So it wasn't easy. Definitely not easy.
Wow. You know, I've heard the Interfaith Ministry organization mentioned several times from, I think, three or maybe all four of you. So that they must be quite an organization. I mean, you all seem to be involved with them.
Interfaith is like really doing a noble work mm-hmm. for refugees, immigrants, changing their life, helping them to survive. Mm-hmm. And they're also delivering 4,000 meals for seniors here in Houston. It's really noble. And they also work in, like, the relation, interfaith relation, working hard to bring all Houston communities together mm-hmm. and build a good relationship between them, between all religions.
Right. Oh, they're the ones who do the Wheels on Meals.
They are. That's
Meals on Wheels.
4,000 meals a day.
Okay. Great.
That's pretty remarkable. And you know, Houston is such a diverse city, but at the same time, we're so blessed to have organizations like the Interfaith Ministry, Refugee Services of Texas, the Alliance, and all they do is not just immigrants and refugees, but the underserved community as well. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a refugee in order to benefit from their services or an immigrant, but also the people who support those organizations. You're really supporting communities. And I believe, you know, when you're investing and you're creating futures that don't exist. Mm-hmm. You really are creating futures. And so for that, we're grateful to be in this amazing mm-hmm. city of Houston.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear Houston seems to be doing a good job with receiving refugees. You know, I went to an Astros game last year, and they had a refugee throw out the ceremonial first pitch. Mm. And I'm watching this. I'm thinking, there is nothing more American than throwing out the ceremonial first pitch at a baseball game. And that kind of gave me goosebumps because I'm thinking, yeah, that felt good for my city and for my Astros.
We got an amazing team. Go Astros.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Now, Salim, can you tell us briefly more about this? You founded the CO Afro Community Center. You founded that here in Houston. What is that?
Yeah, the word is co-Afro. It's Congolese and Afro-Africa. Co-Afro. Just combine those two words. It's the continent, the country in the continent. Congo is the country, Africa is the continent. So the purpose of the center is just, after being here so many years, like 7 years, the community, or my African community, we're still down. The children are not succeeding as they're supposed to be. I prayed to see some children who are becoming doctors, but we don't see anybody anywhere. And when I was trying to study and to learn what is going on, I came to find out that we have so many issues in the community which have no answer. And if nobody stand up to try to solve or to help those children, we will end up nowhere because our country back home still need us. So that way I came up with this idea to create Co-Afro to help these children. And we have Students Ambassador. Well, just to empower the student, want to be there, help them, support, want to support the student technologically, like to teach them how to use the computers. We want to be there to support them emotionally because we found that so many children are parent to their siblings. So to help that gap, we have to stand in the mirror there. And we have that other one called Soiree Culturelle, which is a French word, Soiree Culturelle, to remind them where we came from, what is our culture, and how can we contribute to the country, which mm-hmm. are welcomed as in here. Mm-hmm. That's what we're doing in Co-Afro Community Center.
Wow, that sounds like quite an operation you founded there, Salim.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I kind of want to ask you collectively, did you have a clear destination as America when you were in danger in your homelands? Like Mustafa, did you just want to get out?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's for everybody. Just get out of the harm's way for sure. And a lot of folks, they may not realize, but in order for you to be classified as a refugee, you have to be outside of your own country somewhere else, and that's when you're granted that status and your case gets processed as a refugee, right?
Wait. You can't be a refugee you can't be classified?
Yeah. In order for you to be considered a refugee mm-hmm. and get that designation and be processed as a refugee coming to America, mm-hmm. you cannot be in your own homeland. You have to be out of your home country in some other country, and then apply from that country to seek refuge somewhere else.
I see.
If I can add a little for what he said, and it's not only that, there is a process for you to be approved.
That takes years.
To go out of the refugee mm-hmm. status or like to be resettled to America or somewhere else, which Mustafa said it takes years.
See, that's something I wondered about. If there's turmoil within the borders of one country, and you're fleeing danger, armies, bombs, gunfire, you can't be considered a refugee unless you cross the border into another country.
Mm-hmm. And now imagine hundreds of thousands of people fleeing going to a bordering country. Now, there's consequences on that country too, right? The economic, the political, and all. I mean, they're having all these. Just look at what's going on with the Rohingyas, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just being cast out of their homeland, now going to a homeland where they're not, or they're not a country where they're not welcomed. People feel like, you know, they're stealing jobs and all that stuff. But at the same time, they're not welcomed there, right? So you have to get out of there and you apply to these countries that will potentially accept you,
right.
except that it may take years and years. I know so my family was in Pakistan. We left Afghanistan, ended up in Pakistan. And it took us 5.5 years before our application was accepted. And we ended up coming to the United States.
Okay.
But here's the funny part. If you're coming to the States, you don't know where you're going to end up.
Mm-hmm. So. And you all ended up in Houston.
There we go.
Now, I'd like to ask you maybe one at a time, what is the essential message that you want us listeners to take from your stories? Mustafa, if you could just give us a good hardcore message of what you want people to get out of your story, what you've told us tonight.
Mm. We're human beings, refugees, immigrants. We're all human beings sharing this world, this planet. And I want people to relate to other people, refugees, non-refugees, immigrants, non-immigrants coming from other parts of the world, is that at the end of the day, we are all human beings. We have the same aspirations for our families, for our children. Mm-hmm. We want to be a contribution to our societies, to our country, to the humanity. And we're no different. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Asinja, what is an essential message that you would like our listeners to come away with your story?
Well, I just want to say that in Turkey, when they told me that you're granted a refugee status, I didn't know what's a refugee, honestly. I was telling my husband, we looking for a safe land to start a new life. Not going to add a lot to Mustafa, but we have dreams. We have lives. And all what we want is, you know, to continue living safely.
Sure.
That's all.
Salem, do you have any certain messages you'd like people to get from your story tonight?
Oh, yeah. I would like to say something. You know, when I came to America, I wanted to go to school, but they asked me to show my diploma from back home, which I don't know. I even forgot my medicine. How will I care about a diploma? And what I can say, we want people to accept refugee. Let them embrace us. We can do much better than what maybe they think about a refugee immigrant, as Ahmed and Mustafa said. That's what I say.
Yeah. You know, I've heard people say refugees are a drag on the economy, but from seeing the four of you here tonight, I can tell that's not the case here. Okay, Ahmed, what essential message would you like our listeners to take away from your story?
From my story, I think I can come up with two things. Number one, it's not a choice to become a refugee or an immigrant. You don't choose to be one. You are forced to do it. You're forced to leave your own country.
Right.
The country that you lived at, you have your dreams, your childhood, your memories, everything. The second thing is it's not easy to come into the United States. It's not easy to get approved. That's really the core of my experience.
Right.
4 years of vetting and security check until I was able to come here.
Got it.
And for me... just to add for the economic part, I have my own business now with like a family business. Mm-hmm. It's like, and we work hard, we pay taxes, we contribute to this community.
Okay. Now, quickly, could you all tell me, did you have a particular storyteller in your family? Was there somebody like an uncle or someone quickly, Mustafa. My mom.
Yeah, she's a chatterbox, social butterfly. She loves telling stories, and some of the stuff that I remember are from her stories.
Okay, yeah, it seems like every family seems to have that one storyteller who just grabs. How about you, Asinja?
My grandma.
Your grandmother.
She was a storyteller.
I get maybe that's where you get it from.
Maybe.
Salem.
For me, I got a couple of people. I got my uncle and my grandma. They used to tell us the story. And beautiful ones.
Mm-hmm. Ahmed, were there a storyteller in your family?
I have my older brother. He's a journalist, and he's a writer at the same time. Mm-hmm. And he's really, really good storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Professional.
Yes, yeah, he is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you have any shout-outs tonight? Mustafa, would you like to say hi to anybody?
Shout out to my mom and my lovely wife, Myra, from Canada. Without them, life would be so much difficult.
Yeah. It's good to have that support. Asinja.
My family, my kids, my mom. I hope she's not sleeping and she hear me now.
Mm-hmm.
And to my wife, Nancy, and our little girl, Adonai, and her brother, Emmanuel. And to all Congolese, hey, we don't give up. It's hard, dark, but we'll soon come out. Mm.
To all Congolese who don't give up. I like that. Ahmed.
My shout out for my wife and two little girls and for all those who work for refugee services, whether they are interfaith or other agencies, and for all those Houstonians who would like to volunteer and help refugees. Our doors are open and any time, and we can help them to connect them to our refugees.
Great. Okay. Well, I think you'll notice that we didn't go through a lot of political analysis tonight. We just leave that to other programs. We simply sat here to hear some real stories for some real people. Now we can ponder these stories and hopefully understand each other better, which is what this program is all about. You know, I could talk to you folks all night long. I really could, but we're running out of time here. So I'd like to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for sharing your stories with us. Mustafa, Asinja, Salem, Ahmed, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay.
Thank you.
You bet. We're going to ease on out of here this evening with a Bill Withers song that you all know. I never get tired of this song, you know? And what better song could fit tonight's theme, Lean on Me? Well, Greg Audell will be here next week with a whole new show. And in the meantime, stay where you are, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. You need to
to donate your birthday to KPFT this year. Thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM Houston and online at kpft.org. Your local station board election.